but also narrowing of emotional life, an increased concern with philosophical, religious, and cosmic matters. Remarkable productiveness was seen in many patients. The writing of autobiographies, the filling of endless diaries, obsessive drawing in those graphically inclined, and a general sense of illumination, mission, and fate. This even in poorly educated, unintellectual people who had shown no dispositions in these directions before. Geschwind's first publications regarding the incidence and nature of the syndrome were published in 1974 and 1975 with his colleague Stephen Waxman, and galvanized the neurological world. Here, for the first time, a whole constellation of symptoms and behaviors traditionally suggestive of either mental illness or inspiration were attributed to a specific neurological cause. In particular, as David Baer, another colleague, was to stress, a hyperconnectivity between the sensory and emotional parts of the brain, resulting in greatly heightened and emotionally charged perceptions, memories, and images. Personality change in temporal lobe epilepsy, Geschwind observed, may well be the most important single set of clues we possess to deciphering the neurological systems that underlie the emotional forces that guide behavior. Such changes, Geschwind emphasized, could not be considered either negative or positive as such. What mattered was the role they came to play in a person's life. And this could be creative or destructive, adaptive or maladaptive. He was, however, especially interested in the relatively uncommon situation of a highly creative use of the syndrome. When this tragic disease is visited upon a man of genius, he wrote of Dostoevsky, he is able to extract from it a depth of understanding, a deepening of emotional response. It was the conjunction of disease or biological disposition with individual creativity that excited Geschwind above all. The rather dry term, interictal personality syndrome, was to become Waxman-Geschwind syndrome, or sometimes simply Dostoevsky syndrome. I had to wonder whether the illness that Franco had in 1965, with its intensely vivid dreams, its seizure-like hallucinations, its mystical illuminations and transports, was not indeed the inauguration of such a Dostoevsky syndrome. Hewlings Jackson speaks of the doubling of consciousness that tends to occur in such seizures. And this is how it is with Franco. When he is seized by a vision, a waking dream, a reminiscence of Pontito, he is transported. He is, in a sense, there. His reminiscences come suddenly, unannounced, with the force of revelation. Though he has learned over the years to control them to some extent, to invoke them or conjure them up, as indeed all artists learn to do, they remain, essentially, involuntary. It is precisely this characteristic that Proust holds to be the most valuable. To his mind, voluntary recall is conceptual, conventional and flat. Only involuntary recall, erupting or conjured from the depths, can convey the full quality of childhood experience in all its innocence, wonder, and terror. The doubling of consciousness can be confusing for Franco. The vision of Pontito of the past competes with the here and now, and on occasion can overwhelm it completely, so that he is disoriented, no longer knows where he is. And the doubling of consciousness has led to an odd doubling of life. Franco functions, lives, works in present-day San Francisco, but a large part of him, perhaps the larger part, is living in the past, in Pontito. And with this heightening and intensification of living in the past, there has come a certain impoverishment and depreciation of the here and now. Franco hardly goes out, hardly travels, goes to no films or theaters. He has few recreations or interests other than his art. He used to have many friends, but has lost most of them by his endless talking of Pontito. He works long hours as a cook in San Francisco's North Beach. He walks around all day, oblivious of the world, in a daze of Pontito. And all his relationships have become attenuated with his obsession. All except that with his wife, Ruth. And this was based largely on her sharing his obsession. Thus it was she who opened a gallery in North Beach and named it the Pontito Gallery. She who obtained Pontito license plates for the car. The cost of Franco's nostalgia and art, then, has been his reduction to a sort of half-existence in the present. The psychoanalyst Ernest Schachtel, speaking of Proust, saw him as ready to renounce all that people usually consider an active life, to renounce activity, enjoyment of the present moment, concern for the future, friendship, social intercourse, in his hunt for the remembrance of things past. The sort of memories for which Proust sought, and for which Franco seeks, are elusive, shy, nocturnal. They cannot compete with the full light, the bustle of daily life. Thus they must be invoked, conjured up, like dreams in quiet and darkness, in a cork-lined room, or a mental state akin to trance or reverie. And yet it would be reductive, absurd, to suppose that temporal lobe epilepsy, seizures of reminiscence, even if they do constitute the final trigger of Franco's visions, could be the only determinants of his reminiscence and art. The character of the man, his attachment to his mother, his tendency toward idealization and nostalgia, the actual history of his life, including the sudden loss of his childhood paradise and of his father, and not least, the desire to be known, to achieve, to represent a whole culture, all this surely is equally important. What seemed to have occurred by a singular fortuity was the co-occurrence, the concurrence, of an acute need and a physiological state. For if his sense of exile and loss and nostalgia demanded a sort of world, a substitute for the real world he had lost, his experiential seizures now supplied what he needed. An endless supply of images from the past, or rather, an almost infinitely detailed, three-dimensional model of Pontito. An entire theater or simulacrum he could mentally walk about and explore, capturing new aspects, new views, wherever he looked. This clearly depended equally on his prodigious, pre-existent powers of memory and imagery. As I put the events of 1965 together, I was reminded of the epileptic reminiscence that had attacked, but so deeply served, my patient Mrs. O.C., which provided her, while it lasted, with long-forgotten memories of her past, memories of a most precious and significant kind. But in the case of Mrs. O.C., the epileptic reminiscence tailed off in a few weeks, closing this strange, physiologically opened door to the past, and leaving her, for better or worse, normal once again. For Franco, however, the reminiscence was not to cease, but if anything, swelled in intensity and volume, so that he was never, after this point, really normal again. Such a taking over, a possession or dispossession occurs in a number of people with temporal lobe epilepsy, sometimes greatly heightening, but more often disrupting or destroying their lives. In Franco's case, and here again was a singular fortuity, there was the never-before-realized power to paint his visions, to convey a child's vision with the powers of maturity, and to make of his pathology, his nostalgia, an art. One of Franco's older sisters, Antonietta, now in Holland, remembers when the family returned to the house in Pontito after the Germans had occupied it and found things defaced and changed. Franco's mother was deeply upset, and so was Franco. This 10-year-old fatherless child said to his mother, "I shall make Pontito again for you. I shall create it again for you. And when he did his first painting of the house where he was born, he sent it to her. In some sense, he was redeeming his promise to reconstruct Pontito for her. Franco's mother was always seen by him and by others as a figure of peculiar power. She had the power to cure the children. She taught the secret to my sister Caterina, Franco told me. She also had the power to hurt the body by looking. Such magical thinking was common in Pontito. Franco was always very close to his mother, her favorite, and became much more so with the death of his father, when they seemed to have re-entered a sort of pre-Oedipal, almost symbiotic intimacy and closeness. Franco sent copies of all his paintings to her, and when she died in 1972, he was devastated. With this, he said, I stopped completely painting. He felt it was the end of him, of his life, of his art. He did not paint for 9 months. Then as he emerged, there came an urgent need to find another woman to marry, and now he met his future wife, a young Irish-American artist. When I met Ruth, I wanted to go back to Italy. Ruth, she pulled me back. I said, no more reason to paint now. But Ruth, she replaced my mother. If not for Ruth, I never have painted no more. Franco had a perpetual fantasy of going back to Pontito. He constantly talked about a reunion and going home, and sometimes talked as if his mother was still mysteriously alive, waiting for him in their home, waiting for his return. Yet though he had many opportunities to go back, he managed to sabotage them all. There is something preventing his going back to Pontito, Bob Miller said. Some force, some fear, I don't know what it is. Franco was shocked when he saw photographs of Pontito in the late 70s. The loss of the fields and orchards, the overgrowth, appalled him. And he could hardly bear to look at the photographs that Susan Schwarzenberg took in 1987. None of this was his Pontito, the Pontito of his youth. The Pontito he had hallucinated and dreamed about and painted for more than 20 years. There was an irony and a paradox here. Franco thought of Pontito constantly, saw it in fantasy, depicted it as infinitely desirable. And yet he had a profound reluctance to return. But it is precisely such a paradox that lies at the heart of nostalgia. For nostalgia is about a fantasy that never takes place, one that maintains itself by not being fulfilled. And yet, such fantasies are not just idle daydreams or fancies. They press towards some sort of fulfillment, but an indirect one, the fulfillment of art. These, at least, are the terms that Guy Jachon, the French psychoanalyst, has used. With reference in particular to the greatest of nostalgics, Proust. The psychoanalyst David Wurman speaks of an aesthetic crystallization of nostalgia. Nostalgia raised to the level of art and myth. There is no doubt that Franco is at once the victim and the possessor of an imagery whose power is difficult for us to conceive. He is not at liberty to misremember, nor is he at liberty to stop remembering. There beats down on him night and day, whether he likes it or not, a reminiscence of almost intolerable power and exactness. No one has felt the heat and pressure of reality as indefatigable as that which day and night converged upon the hapless Ireneo. Borges writes in a sketch entitled Funes de Memorias. Such an intolerably vivid reality converges upon Franco, too. One may be born with the potential for a prodigious memory, but one is not born with a disposition to recollect. This comes only with changes and separations in life, separations from people, from places, from events and situations, especially if they have been of great significance, have been deeply hated or loved. It is thus discontinuities, the great discontinuities in life, that we seek to bridge or reconcile or integrate by recollection, and beyond this by myth and art. Discontinuity and nostalgia are most profound if, in growing up, we leave or lose the place where we were born and spent our childhood. If we become expatriates or exiles, if the place or the life we were brought up in is changed beyond recognition or destroyed. All of us finally are exiles from the past. But this is particularly true for Franco, who feels himself the sole survivor and rememberer of a world forever past. Whatever Franco's personal gifts and pathologies, his memory, his gift for painting, his seizures, perhaps, his nostalgia, he is also moved, and has been moved throughout, by a feeling and motive that transcend the personal, by a cultural need to remember the past, to preserve its meaning or give it new meaning in a world that has forgotten it. In brief, we see in Franco's work the art of the exile. Much art, much mythology indeed, stems from exile. Exile from the garden, from Zion, is a central myth in the Bible, perhaps in every religion. Exile, of course, and perhaps, though hugely transformed, a sort of nostalgia, are central dynamics in Joyce's life and work. He left Dublin never to return as a very young man, but the image of Dublin haunts everything he wrote. First, as the literal background of Stephen Hero, Dubliners, and exiles. And then, as the increasingly mythologized and universalized backdrop of Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. Joyce's memory of Dublin was prodigious and was continually amplified and complemented by meticulous research. But it was the Dublin of his youth that inspired him. He had little interest in its later development. And so, in a more modest way, it is with Franco. Pontito is the background of all his thoughts, from the most personal, quotidian recollections to allegorical visions of Pontito as the center of a cosmic struggle between the eternal forces of good and evil. In March of 1989, I went to Pontito to see the village for myself and to talk to some of Franco's relatives there. I found the village itself, compared with the paintings, at once extraordinarily similar and totally different. There is an almost photographic fidelity, an amazing microscopic power of reproduction in the way Franco recollects, 30 years later, the details of Pontito. And yet, at the same time, I was struck by the differences. Pontito is much smaller than one would think from his paintings. The streets are narrower, the house is more irregular, the church tower shorter and more squat. There are many reasons for this, one of which is that Franco paints what he saw with a child's eye, and to a child everything is taller and more spacious. The literalness of this child's eye vision made me wonder whether, through some legerdemain of the brain, Franco was able, or even forced, to re-experience Pontito exactly as he had experienced it as a child. Whether he was given access, a convulsive access, to the child's memories within him. Precisely such an access to the past, a past preserved unchanged in the brain's archives, was described to Wilder Penfield, so he thought, by some of his patients with temporal lobe epilepsy. These memories could be evoked during surgery by stimulating the affected part of the temporal lobes with an electrode. While the patients remained perfectly conscious of being in the operating room, questioned by their surgeon, they would also feel themselves transported to a time in the past, always the same time, the same scene for any particular individual. The actual experiences evoked during such seizures varied enormously from patient to patient. One might re-experience a time of listening to music, another looking at the door of a dance hall, or lying in the delivery room at birth, or watching people enter the room with snow on their clothes. Because the reminiscence remained constant for each patient with every seizure or stimulation, Penfield speaks of them as experiential seizures. He conceives that memory forms a continuous and complete record of life experience, and that a segment of this is evoked and played convulsively, involuntarily during the seizures. For the most part, he feels that the particular memories activated in this way lack special significance and are merely inconsequential segments activated at random. But on occasion he grants that such segments might be particularly prone to activation because they are so important, so massively represented in the brain. Was this then what was happening to Franco? Was he being forced to see, convulsively, frozen segments of his own past, photographs from his brain's archive? The notion that past memories endure in the brain, though in a somewhat less literal, less mechanical form, is an idea that haunts psychoanalysis, and the great autobiographers as well. Thus Freud's favorite image of the mind was as an archaeological site filled layer by layer with the buried strata of the past, but one where these layers may rise into consciousness at any time. And Proust's image of life was as a collection of moments, the memories of which are not informed of everything that has happened since, and remain hermetically sealed like jars of preserves in the mind's larder. Proust is only one of the great meditators on memory. Wondering about memory goes back at least to Augustine, without any resolution, finally, as to what memory is. This notion of memory as a record or store is so familiar, so congenial to us, that we take it for granted and do not realize at first how problematic it is. And yet all of us have had the opposite experience, of normal memories, everyday memories being anything but fixed, slipping and changing, becoming modified whenever we think of them. No two witnesses ever tell the same story. And no story, no memory ever remains the same. A story is repeated, gets changed with every repetition. It was experiments with such serial storytelling, and with the remembering of pictures, that convinced Frederick Bartlett in the 1920s and 1930s that there is no such entity as memory, but only the dynamic process of remembering. He is always at pains in his great book, Remembering, to avoid the noun and use the verb. He writes, "Remembering is not the re-excitation of innumerable fixed, lifeless, and fragmentary traces. It is an imaginative reconstruction or construction built out of the relation of our attitude towards a whole active mass of organized past reactions or experience, and to a little outstanding detail, which commonly appears in image or in language form. It is thus hardly ever really exact, even in the most rudimentary cases of rote recapitulation. And it is not at all important that it should be so." Bartlett's conclusion now finds the strongest support in Gerald Edelman's neuroscientific work, his view of the brain as a ubiquitously active system where a constant shifting is in process, and everything is continually updated and recorrelated. There is nothing camera-like, nothing mechanical in Edelman's view of the mind. Every perception is a creation, every memory a recreation. All remembering is relating, generalizing, recategorizing. In such a view, there cannot be any fixed memories, any pure view of the past, uncolored by the present. For Edelman, as for Bartlett, there are always dynamic processes at work, and remembering is always reconstruction, not reproduction. And yet one wonders whether there are not extraordinary forms or pathological forms of memory where this does not apply. What, for example, are the seemingly permanent and totally replicable memories of Luria's mnemonist, so akin to the fixed and rigid artificial memories of the past? What are the highly accurate archival memories found in oral cultures, where entire tribal histories, mythologies, epic poems are transmitted faithfully through a dozen generations? What of the capacity of idiot savants to remember books, music, pictures verbatim, and to reproduce them virtually unchanged years later? What of traumatic memories that seem to replay themselves unbearably without changing a single detail? Freud's repetition compulsion for years or decades after the trauma. What of neurotic or hysterical memories or fantasies, which also seem immune to time? In all of these, seemingly, there are immense powers of reproduction at work. But very much less in the way of reconstruction, as with Franco's memories. One feels that there is some element of fixation or fossilization or petrification at work, as if they are cut off from the normal processes of recategorization and revision. It may be that we need to call upon both sorts of concept, memory as dynamic, as constantly revised and represented, but also as images, still present in their original form, though written over and over again by subsequent experience, like palimpsests. In this sense, with Franco, however sharp and fixed the original, there is always some reconstruction in his work as well, particularly in the most personal pictures, such as the view from his bedroom window. Here Franco brings into an intensely personal and aesthetic unity a range of buildings that cannot be seen or photographed all at once, but that he has observed lovingly at different times. He has constructed an ideal view, which has the truth of art and transcends factuality. Whatever photographic or eidetic power Franco brings to it, such a painting always has a subjectivity, an intensely personal cast as well. Schachtel, speaking as a psychoanalyst, discusses this in relation to childhood memories. Memory as a function of the living personality can be understood only as a capacity for the organization and reconstruction of past experiences and impressions in the service of present needs, fears, and interests. Just as there is no such thing as impersonal perception and impersonal experience, there is also no impersonal memory. Kierkegaard goes still further in the opening of Stages on Life's Way. Memory is merely a minimal condition. By means of memory, the experience presents itself to receive the consecration of recollection. For recollection is ideality. It involves effort and responsibility, which the indifferent act of memory does not involve. Hence, it is an art to recollect. Franco's Pontito is minutely accurate in the tiniest details, and yet it is also serene and idyllic. There is a great stillness in it, a sense of peace, not least because his Pontito is depopulated. Its buildings and streets are empty. The bustling, transitory people have been removed. There is something of a desolate, a post-nuclear quality. But there is also a deeper, more spiritual stillness. One cannot help feeling that something is strange here. That what is being recalled is not the actuality of childhood, as with Proust, but a denying and transfiguring vision of childhood, with the place Pontito taking the place of the people, the parents, the living people, who must have been so important to the child. Franco is not unaware of this, and will in some moods talk of the reality of childhood as he knew it, its complexities, its conflicts, its griefs, and its pains. But all of this is edited out in his art, where a paradisiacal simplicity prevails. One finds the belief in a happy childhood, even in people who have undergone cruel experiences as children, Schachtel writes. The myth of happy childhood takes the place of the lost memory of the actual experience. And yet, we cannot reduce Franco's vision to mere fantasy or obsession. There is not just a neurotic deletion in his Pontito paintings, but an imaginative bringing out and intensification. Eva Braun, the philosopher, likes to call memory the storehouse of the imagination. And like Edelman, to see memories as imaginative, as creative from the start. Imaginative memory not only stores for us the passing moments of perception, it also transfigures distances, vivifies, defangs, reshapes formed impressions, turns oppressive immediacies into wide vistas, loosens the rigid grip of an acute desire, and transforms it into a fertile design. And it is at this point that Franco's personal nostalgic feelings become cultural transcendent ones. Pontito, he feels, is special in God's eyes, and must be preserved from destruction and corruption. It is special, too, in embodying a precious culture, a mode of building, a mode of living that has almost vanished from the earth. He sees his mission as one of preservation, to preserve Pontito exactly as it was, above and beyond all vicissitudes and contingencies. That this is a central dynamic, or the central dynamic, is shown by a series of remarkable apocalyptic or science fiction paintings, which he seems to do in periods of mental stress or distress. In these, the Earth is menaced by another planet or a comet, by imminent or actual destruction. But Pontito survives. Franco shows the old church, or a garden, all green and gold, radiant, transfigured in a beam of sunlight, miraculously surviving the all-encompassing destruction. In another allegorical picture, he put a satellite dish on the church, a dish aimed at the stars and at God. These apocalyptic paintings have titles like Pontito Preserved for Eternity in Infinite Space. Franco gets up early each morning and knows what he has to do. He has his task, his mission, to recollect, to consecrate the memory of Pontito. His visions, when they come, are full of emotion and excitement, no less so than they were when they first came to him 25 years ago. And the activity of painting, of walking again in recollection through the so-loved paths and streets, and being able to articulate this in so masterly a fashion, with such richness and detail, gives him a sense of identity and accomplishment by giving his visions a controlled and artistic form. I don't feel that I deserve the credit for these paintings. Franco wrote me in a letter. I did them for Pontito. I want the whole world to know how fantastic and beautiful it is. In this way, maybe it won't die. Although it is dying. Maybe my paintings would at least keep its memory alive. Up to early 1989, I had seen Franco and visited him at his house in San Francisco several times. I had spoken with his friends there. I had met two of his sisters in Holland. And above all, I had visited Pontito, which excited and teased Franco. For he was thinking now, more than at any time in the past 20 years, of visiting Pontito himself. His life had had, until now, a strange sort of stability, with living, eating, functioning, somewhat absent-mindedly in the present, but with his mind and art constantly fixed on the past. In this he had been greatly aided by Ruth, who, though herself an artist, had identified herself in the deepest way with Franco's Pontitan relationship and art, and did all she could to take care of the mundane necessities of life and to give him the protection and insulation he needed to dwell and work uninterrupted in his nostalgic art. But in 1987, tragically, she became sick, and after a painful fight with cancer, she died, just 3 months before Franco's Exploratorium exhibit. This was his first big show. And along with his wife's death, it stirred feelings that he could no longer go on as he had in the past. Something new must happen. New decisions must be made. He sounded these themes in a letter he wrote me a month later. Very shortly I may be moving, probably to San Francisco, but maybe back to Italy for good. My situation since my wife died has been difficult for me. I'm not sure what I should do. I must sell my house, look for a new place and job in San Francisco, or in the future go back to Pontito. So that will be the end of the Pontito memory, but not the end of my life. I'll start a new memory. I was struck by the way in which he equated a return to Pontito with the end of his memory, his identity, the end of his singular reminiscence and art. One saw now why he had sabotaged all previous opportunities to go there. Could the fairy tale, the myth, survive reality? In March of 1989, I spoke of Franco and his art at a conference in Florence. Invitations started to pour in on Franco, to give interviews, to send slides, to allow an exhibit, and above all, to return to Pontito. Pescia, the nearest big town in Pontito, organized an exhibit of his paintings to be held in September 1990. His long-standing inner conflict was magnified by this outside notice. A state of excitement and ambivalence and agitation grew. Finally, that summer, he decided to go. He had envisaged walking from Pescia, walking up the winding mountain road to Pontito, carrying on his back a wooden cross he had made, which he would place in the old church at Pontito. He would be alone, utterly alone, in this consecrated walk. He would stop at a spring, an ancient spring of fresh water just outside Pontito, and put his face in the gushing waters. Perhaps after drinking the waters, he thought, he would lie down and die. Or perhaps, purified, born again, he would re-enter Pontito. No one would recognize him, the grizzled stranger from afar, until an old dog, the old dog he had known as a child, now so old it could scarcely move. The dog indeed would have to be the same age as Franco himself. Until his old dog, recognizing him, would feebly lick him and then, its waiting over, would wag its tail and die. It was singular to hear this elaborate fantasy from Franco, this fantasy with elements of Sophocles and Homer, no less than the New Testament, for he had never read, never heard of Sophocles or Homer. In the event, his return was nothing like this. He had phoned me in a panic, the evening before his flight. Innumerable thoughts and desires and fears were colliding inside him. Should he go or shouldn't he? He kept changing his mind. Since his art was based on fantasy and nostalgia, on a memory uncontaminated by updating, he was terrified that he would lose it if he returned to Pontito. I listened carefully, like an analyst, offering no suggestions. "You have to decide," I said finally. He took the red-eye flight later that evening. He had hoped that, first, he might meet the Pope and have his cross blessed before he walked with it to Pontito. But the Pope was away in Africa. Nor was the Via Dolorosa walk to Pontito possible. The mayor of Pescia and other officials were at this moment, he was told, awaiting him in Pontito, and he was whisked off there at high speed in a car. The ceremony over, Franco took off by himself, going to his boyhood home. His first impression? Oh my God, it was so small I had to crouch to look through my window. I see changes outside, but to me is no change. As he walked around the town, it seemed uncannily quiet, deserted. Like everybody is left, like the town is mine. He savored, for a little, this sense that it was his, and then got a sense of grievous loss. I missed the chickens, the donkey shoes. Like a dream, everybody left. You used to hear a lot of noise. The children coming up, the women, the donkey shoes, all gone. No one greeted him, no one recognized him. No one was to be seen on the streets during this first walk. He saw no curtains in the windows and no laundry hanging, heard no sounds of life coming from the empty, shuttered houses. He encountered only half-feral cats slinking in the alleys. The feeling grew in him that Pontito was indeed dead, and he himself a revenant returning to a ghost town. He wandered out beyond the houses into the areas that used to be lush with well-tended fields and orchards. Everywhere the ground was cracked and dry. There was neglect and a huge overgrowth of parasites and weeds. Now it seemed to him not only Pontito, but the whole enterprise of civilization was in ruins. He thought of his own apocalyptic visions. Someday we'll be polluted, overgrown. There will be nuclear war. So I will put it in space, to be preserved for eternity. But then, as the sun rose, the sheer beauty of the scene made him catch his breath. I can't believe it, it's so beautiful. There, rising up tier by tier on the mountain, was Pontito. His Pontito, all green and gold. The church tower at its crest, glinting now in the early morning sun. His church, completely unchanged. I went up in the tower. I touched the stones. Its age to me is like 1,000 years. All different colors, the copper, the green. Touching the stones, stroking them, caressing them, Franco grounded himself, started to feel again that Pontito was real. Stones have always played a crucial role in his paintings. They are portrayed with the utmost accuracy. Every shade, every color, every convexity or crack, lovingly dwelt on and delineated. There is an extraordinary tactile or kinesthetic quality in Franco's stones. Now, as he touched them, the actuality of coming home started to return, and for the first time during his visit, Franco started to rejoice. The stones, at least, had not changed, nor had the church or the buildings or the streets. Their feel, at least, was still what it had been. And now the villagers, many of them relatives, came out of their houses, excitedly greeting him, bombarding him with questions. Everyone was proud of him. "We've seen your paintings. We've been hearing about you. You're coming back to us now?" And now he started to feel like the prodigal son. This, he said later, was a high point of his trip. "As a young child in Pontito, I thought, one day I'm going to grow up, do something, be somebody for my madre, show the people in Pontito. After my father died, I had no shoes, all broke. I used to feel shame. We were despised." His childhood fantasy was coming true. Franco had done something, was somebody, and now people, not just people in America or Italy, but his own people, the Pontitans, loved and admired him. A tender feeling for the people, my people, seized him. They could not remember the past as he did. Their memories lacked the power of his, or had been updated, effacing the past. This was evident whenever he spoke to them. He then would be their archive, their memory. "I bring back the memory to these people." And he later said to the mayor, "I'm going to build a gallery, a little museum, something to bring the people back to the town." On the surface, returning to Pontito was not as intense an experience as he had expected. There had been no mystical revelations, no ecstasies on the heights, but neither had he dropped dead from poisoned waters or had a heart attack, as he had also more than half expected. It was when he left that he really felt the impact. Back in San Francisco, he found himself in a crisis. First, there was an overwhelming sensory confusion. He seemed to see two pictures of Pontito, two newsreels, as he put it, running simultaneously in his head, with the more recent, the new, tending to blot out the old. He could do nothing to stop this perceptual conflict, and when he tried to paint Pontito, he found that he no longer knew what to do. "I get confused. I see these two pictures at once," he told me. "I thought I would paint Pontito as it was, but I see it as it is now. I thought I would go crazy. What could I do? Maybe I could never paint Pontito again. I got scared. My God, now, start all over again?" It took me 10 days to come back. It took 10 days for the hallucinatorily vivid pictures of the new Pontito to die down, to stop competing with the old Pontito. 10 days for the merely sensory conflict to resolve. And as for his emotions, they were so confused he hardly dared think about them. At this point, almost desperate, he said, "I wish I never went back. I work best with my fantasy. I can't work now." It was a month before he started to draw Pontito again. These new drawings and paintings, just a few inches square, took on an unusually tender and intimate quality. Corners, nooks where a boy might sit. Nooks where he had sat and dreamt as a child. These little scenes, though they did not contain human figures, had an intensely human feel, as if their occupants had just left or were just about to arrive. Very different from the idealized yet deserted scenes he had usually painted. Thinking over the experience, Franco felt that it had been both enjoyable and exhausting, but compromised at a deeper level in his 3 weeks there, because he had had no time to himself. He had been followed and interviewed every day in Pontito, and had had no time to sketch or think. He felt a need to go back a second time, to confront the deeper issues, to spend time alone in Pontito. In March 1991, there was a second exhibit of Franco's paintings in Italy, this one in the Palazzo Medici Riccardi in Florence, and I accompanied Franco to the exhibit. He was abashed by the splendid surroundings, by seeing his paintings in vast palatial rooms. "I feel like an intruder," he said. "They do not belong." He and his paintings, he feels, are rooted in the hilly Tuscan countryside. He feels uncomfortable in the cosmopolitan grandeur of Florence. The next morning, Franco and I are off to Pontito. For the first time, we will see his town together. We pass the Duomo and the Baptistry in the center of Florence, pass the old children's hospital, the Innocenti, driving through the miraculously preserved old city, unspoiled and deserted now, near dawn on a Sunday. Franco beside me is rapt, absorbed in his thoughts. We pass the road for Pistoia and head toward Monte Catini, the slopes on either side of us dotted with old hill towns. There is at the back of every artist's mind something like a pattern or a type of architecture. G.K. Chesterton wrote, "It is a thing like the landscape of his dreams, the sort of world he would wish to make or in which he would wish to wander, the strange flora and fauna of his own secret planet." For Auden, the landscape was limestone and lead mines. For Franco, it is this old, gnarled, unchanging Tuscan landscape. A sign warning motorists of snow prompts me to ask Franco whether there was ever snow in Pontito, or whether he had ever painted a snow-whitened Pontito. "Yes, there was snow," he says, "and he once started a snowscape, but almost all his paintings are of Pontito in primavera, in spring." As we reach Pescia, at the bottom of the mountain, below Pontito, Franco recognizes people and places. The shop where he used to buy paints 40 years ago, a subterranean bar. Little has changed in this slow-paced town. He recognizes the mailman from the 1940s. They throw their arms around each other in the street. Everyone is welcoming. There are smiles everywhere for the prodigal son come home once more. We move on to the city hall, where Franco was given the honors of the city during his first visit. A prophet is honored now in his own land. This pleases him, this local fame. He belongs here, as he does not belong in Florence. From Pescia, the road is narrow and steep. We wind up in second gear after nearly ditching ourselves on the first turn, past Pietrabuona, a town named after its fine stone, with its church and oldest buildings perched on its highest hill. We pass its terraced hills, softly lit with gnarled olive trees and vines upon them, These terraces are ancient, dating from Etruscan times. We wind around past many small villages, Castelvecchio, Stiappa, San Quirico. Finally, we round another bend in the road and catch our first sight of Pontito.
My God, look at it,
Franco exclaims sotto voce.
Jesus Christ, I can see my home.
No, I can't. This overgrowth is bad. Parasites everywhere. Used to be cherry, pear, fruit trees, chestnuts, grains, corn, lentils. He tells me how, as a lanky, long-legged youth, he used to stride from one village to another. As we approach Pontito, Franco's eyes grow moist. He stares intensely and murmurs to himself as he takes everything in.
This is the bridge, the stream where we did the washing. Down the path here, the women would walk with baskets on their heads.
We stop the car and Franco leaps out, seeing and remembering more details all the time. And along with this pure topographic memory, there is also a cultural one. He describes how the villagers would take hemp and immerse it in the stream for a year, anchor it by rocks, and then take it out to be dried and woven into fabric for sheets and towels, and for sacks for chestnuts. A whole local industry, a tradition now nearly forgotten, except by Franco. Suddenly indignant at new growth obscuring the path, he tears it out in giant armfuls. Angry at some new building, he tells me in detail exactly how it used to be.
There was a big rock there. The water ran here.
There is no doubt that every stone, every inch is engraved in his memory.
Come sta?
Climbing up the steep cobbled street, Franco greets a stout middle-aged man in a green coat.
His father gave us candies.
Franco has a bardic memory. But the trivial and the momentous, the personal and the mythic, are indiscriminately mixed. He stops at the house where his mother was born.
Sabatoni! Franco!
An old man emerges.
It's my uncle. You've been in America. What brings you back? I heard there was a show in Florence.
The old man mentions the drying of chestnuts. He forgets the details, but Franco does not. The old man points out that the four houses next to his, so full of life once, are now empty.
When I am dead, it will be empty here too.
We visit Franco's sister Caterina. She and her husband have retired to Pontito, and Franco is distressed to see her looking older than he remembers. Caterina feeds us a magnificent Tuscan lunch, cheese, bread, olives, wine, tomatoes, preserved from her garden. And then Franco takes me off to look at the church. It is a beautiful spot, atop the hill and overlooking the rest of the village. In the cemetery, Franco points out the graves of his mother, his father, this relative and that.
There are more people in the graveyard than in the town, he says softly.
Franco plans to stay in Pontito for 3 more weeks to do some quiet sketching. He says, I'm going to put my roots back here. But as I leave, my final image is of Franco standing by himself in the cemetery, gazing over the depopulated town, alone. Franco's 3 weeks in Pontito seem to recharge him. At least, he has been incessantly active since his return. His garage studio is crackling with life. There are pictures everywhere, old and new. The new ones based on sketches he did in March, and the old ones, started in 1987, but left unfinished with Ruth's death, now being completed in a burst of new decision and energy. Seeing Franco once again at work, his renewed fury of recollective and creative energy raises anew all the questions one has about his singular enterprise, the meaning of Pontito for him. His new paintings are not really new. He may add the new here and there, a fence, a gate, a new tree perhaps, but they remain essentially the same. His project, in a fundamental sense, remains unchanged. When I visited Franco last summer, I saw a pair of sneakers hanging from the rafters of his garage, with an elaborately calligraphed notice tied to them, saying in Italian, "With these shoes, after 34 years, I first set foot in what had been the promised land." Now that he had set foot in it, it had lost some of its glamour, its promise. Sometimes I wish I never went back, he said as he saw me looking at the shoes. Fantasy, memory, that is the most beautiful. And then he added musingly, art is like dreaming. Seeing the current reality of Pontito was very disturbing to Franco, although he was able to recover from the derailment it caused. But it heightened his sense that the Pontito of here and now is a threat to his own vision, and showed him that he must ration any further exposure to it. There have been many subsequent invitations, but he has not returned, even for an exhibit of his own work in the streets of Pontito. Other artists now are flocking to Pontito, but for them it is just another charming Tuscan hill town. Franco, fleeing all this, has returned to his garage, returned to the project that has consumed him for 29 years. It is a project that has no end, can never be brought to a conclusion or completion, and he paints now, one sometimes feels, in a sort of frenzy, barely finishing one canvas before moving on to another. He is experimenting with other forms of representation as well. Cardboard models of Pontito, which he fashions with his long, agile fingers, and videotapes of his paintings, accompanied by music to simulate a walk through the town. He is fascinated by the idea of computer simulations of Pontito, and the thought that one might don helmet and gloves and not only see but touch its virtual reality too. When I met him originally, Franco was billed as a memory artist, implying his affinity to Proust, the poet of memory. At first I thought there was indeed a similarity. Both men, both artists, withdrawing themselves from the world in order to recapture the lost world of childhood. But now one sees, increasingly with each year, how totally Franco's project differs from Proust's. Proust, too, was haunted by the lost, the forgotten past, and his quest was to find if the door to it could be opened. As he succeeded in this, partly through the grace of involuntary memories, partly through vast intellectual labor, his work could reach its completion and conclusion, a completion at once psychological and artistic. But this is not possible for Franco, who, instead of achieving a penetration into the inwardness, the meaning of Pontito, makes a vast, even infinite enumeration of all its outward aspects, its buildings, its streets, its stones, its topography, as if these could in some way compensate for the human void within. He half knows this, yet does not know it, and in any case has no choice. He has no time for, no taste for, no power of introspection, and may suspect indeed that it would be fatal to his art. Franco feels he has 20-30 years of work still ahead of him. For the 1,000-odd paintings he has done since 1970 convey only a part of the reality he seeks to portray. He has to have paintings or simulations of every detail, from every viewpoint. From the village in the distance, as one drives up to it from Pistoia, to the finest details of the lichened stones in the church. He envisions the building of a museum overlooking the town, which will house a vast archive of Pontito, his Pontito, the thousands of paintings he has made, and the thousands more he still intends to make. It will be the culmination of his life's work, and the redemption of his promise to his mother. I shall create it again for you. Prodigies. The Fayetteville Observer of May 19, 1862, contained an unusual letter from its correspondent, Long Grabs, stationed in Camp Mangum. The blind Negro Tom has been performing here to a crowded house. He is certainly a wonder. He resembles any ordinary Negro boy, 13 years old, and is perfectly blind and an idiot in everything but music, language, imitation, and perhaps memory. He has never been instructed in music or educated in any way. He learned to play the piano from hearing others, learns airs and tunes from hearing them sung, and can play any piece on first trial as well as the most accomplished performer. One of his most remarkable feats was the performance of 3 pieces of music at once. He played Fisher's hornpipe with one hand and Yankee Doodle with the other, and sang Dixie all at once. He also played a piece with his back to the piano and his hands inverted. He performs many pieces of his own conception. One, his Battle of Manassas, may be called picturesque and sublime, a true conception of unaided, blind musical genius. This poor blind boy is cursed with but little of human nature. He seems to be an unconscious agent acting as he is acted on, and his mind a vacant receptacle where nature stores her jewels to recall them at her pleasure. We learn more of blind Tom from Edouard Seguin, the French physician whose 1866 book, Idiocy and Its Treatment by the Psychological Method, contained many penetrating descriptions of individuals later to be termed idiots savants, and from an intellectual descendant of Seguin, Darrell Treffert, whose book, Extraordinary People, Understanding Idiot Savants, was published in 1989. Born nearly blind, the 14th child of a slave, sold to a Colonel Bethune, Tom was from infancy, Treffert writes, fascinated by sounds of all sorts, rain on the roof, the grating of corn in the sheller, but most of all music. Tom would listen intensely to the colonel's daughters practicing their sonatas and minuets on the piano. Till 5 or 6 years old, Seguin writes, he could not speak, scarce walk, and gave no other sign of intelligence than this everlasting thirst for music. At 4 years already, if taken out from the corner where he lay dejected and seated at the piano, he would play beautiful tunes, his little hands having already taken possession of the keys, and his wonderful ear of any combination of notes they had once heard. At the age of 6, Tom started to improvise on his own account. Word of the blind genius spread, and at 7, Tom gave his first concert, and went on to earn $100,000 in his 8th year. At 11, he played before President Buchanan at the White House. A panel of musicians who thought that he had tricked the president tested his memory the following day, playing 2 entirely new compositions to him, 13 and 20 pages in length. He reproduced them perfectly and without the least apparent effort. Seguin, describing Tom listening to a new piece, adds further tantalizing details in regard to his expressions, postures, and movements. He shows his satisfaction by his countenance, a laughing, stooping with various rubbings of the hand, alternating with an increase of the sideways swinging of his body, and some uncouth smiles. As soon as the new tune begins, Tom takes some ludicrous posture, with one leg outstretched,